Our next discussant is Ximena Canales, a historian of science at Harvard, whose book, A Tenth of a Second, on the history of the thinking about this perceptual moment, this very brief flash of time, has won wide notice for its mix of philosophy, history of science and technology, and cultural history. More generally, she writes on histories of film and facts.
Thanks so much, everybody, for coming and listening to all these papers. The microphone, sorry. Is this better? Good. Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank Hillel for such a wonderful and provocative talk. I also had the advantage of reading the paper, and I hope that in my commentary I can bring out some aspects of it, because it is a quite complicated paper. Yes, okay. Is this a little better? Sorry, better? All the way. And the, okay. Please feel free to remind me again if you can't hear. So a part of Hillel's paper deals with the relationship of the inexpressible and ineffable to their opposite. And his first illustration is the apparent paradox, starting with the inscription entering the Church of Atotonilco in Mexico, that directly references, and I quote, the inexpressible terror of Christ's sacrifice and the ineffable Trinity. So the inscription at the entrance of the church belies the excess of expression everywhere else. His question then is, how can we make sense of this paradox? So the problem of the relation between the effable, the sayable, and the representable, and of course their opposite, is one of the largest and farthest reaching metaphysical questions. I think Hillel's division of eight adds important nuances to the broader category of what is unhearable. So the question of what can be and cannot be represented has, of course, been of concern to theologians. Think of it in terms of its normative biblical form, the famous sentence, "Thou shalt not make graven images." But I also will talk in my commentary of it in terms of the work of more recent philosophers and historians such as Foucault, psychologists, Jacques Lacan, and media theorists like Frederick Kittler. So we can now safely say that a meta question has arisen. I think that this conference itself makes that clear. The relation between the representable and unrepresentable was first clearly and explicitly no longer normative by early modern times. Frederick Kittler traces the end of the normative regime to the invention and quick proliferation of the camera obscura, tracing it to its use by Brunelleschi and to the subsequent expansion of linear perspective, a technique which itself was based on camera obscura optics in the Renaissance. So Kittler turns not to the Church of Atotonilco in Mexico, but to a painting of the Church of San Giovanni in Florence. And this painting was done inside the church, which was right in front of it, of San Maria de Fiore. And what Brunelleschi did, he did a painting, and then he poked a hole in the middle of it, and he turned it backwards. He was standing inside the church, the big Duomo church in Florence. He turned it backwards and saw through the hole, and he could see the facade of the church, which was right across Santa Maria de Fiore, the baptistry of San Giovanni. Then he put a mirror in front of the painting, and you could see the church was then, what you were seeing was really the painting and not the church right in front of you. So Brunelleschi's big contribution was that people were not noticing if there was a mirror or not, because the rules of perspective were so close to the rules of optics. So this painting and Brunelleschi's subsequent work and of Alberti and others after him was one of the first to combine camera obscura technologies with mathematically precise theories of linear perspective. So to the normative biblical injunction where creating images in likeness was the power of gods, and think here as well of the saying of humans are created by God in his image, appeared a new configuration characterizing the Reformation revolution in terms of biblical interpretation, and this is connected to the printing press, and perspectival art connected to the camera obscura. We have come a long way since then. So to the basic question of what is expressible or inexpressible in a given point in time, we must now add, how can we think about what constitutes a given regime of expressibility? So I will give you some partial, very sketchy reference points to think about this question. I think the category of the unconscious is important, and of course the unconscious is not the same as the inexpressible, but there are relations there. And Walter Benjamin added another new and particularly strong ingredient into the psychoanalytic category when he introduced the concept of the optical unconscious. So with this, he invited us to think about the relation between the unconscious and media technologies. The two defined each other in ways that Benjamin himself was unable to explore. But the object that Benjamin confronted, what motivated to introduce this new term, was film, in particular film stills and high-speed photographs that had been around since the 1870s. Since then, photographs showing a horse in gallop had shown to many that the world as we knew it really was very different from how it really was. So Benjamin claimed that the images revealed by these technologies should be understood arising from an optical unconscious, analogous to the unconscious of the mind, similarly analyzable and similarly treatable. Studying this optical unconscious was not a simple task. He said, we have no idea at all what happens in the fraction of time when a person steps out. But what I want to stress the words used repeatedly by Benjamin. He said, one knows nothing and we have no idea. Yet a clear, scientifically vouchsafed result emerges in case of the photographs. Benjamin was in no way deprecatory of these techniques by pointing their connection to something obscure like the unconscious. In a famous phrase, he argued that film had turned a tenth of a second, the period of time which we have no knowledge and is essentially unrepresentable, into an explosive dynamite capable of bursting open what he called the prison doors of modernity. And I will return to the connection to the dynamite later. So Benjamin's famous reference to the tenth of a second formed part of his larger work on film. And what is important to stress here is that film's revelation of short moments of time did not occur through a simple expansion of time. It did not represent a straightforward, ever-increasing ability to peer into shorter and shorter periods. So the magnification of these moments disclosed, according to Benjamin, an entirely different nature. But if these images were not simply more precise or more enlarged versions of the real, what were they? What was this different nature and how could we get at it? So I want to summarize this part of my commentary by just saying that we have two main ingredients with Freud and Bergson. One is the need to pay attention to the unconscious, which is Freud, and secondly to its media components, which is Benjamin. Another important moment is Jacques Lacan, who then chastised Freud for defining the unconscious negatively. Freud argued Lacan made us think that the unconscious was, in a sense, secondary to consciousness. This was not true. It was just as important, if not more, according to Lacan. So the important term for many post-Lacanian theory is not the unconscious, but the virtual. And the importance of the thinking of the virtual as the space of the unrepresentable was brought forth earlier by the French philosopher Henri Bergson. And Bergson was in many senses inaugurating a veritable cult of the unrepresentability, since he wrote his famous book Creative Evolution in 1907. And in this last work, he set up a list of dichotomies where representation was on one of the sides and unrepresentability, the unrepresented, was on the other side. And I'll tell you all the things that he associated with this broad. This isn't a column of eight, but just of two, but it's still complicated. So on the one hand was representation, and on the other hand was what he called a pregnancy of representations. Representation was related to mercantilism, the other to asceticism. Broadly and imperfectly, but he located technology on the side of representation and science on the other side. One was linked to the natural, the other was acquired. One was effortless, the other required effort. One was social, the other was human. One was infra-intellectual, the other one was supra-intellectual. One gave us pleasure, the other and well-being, and the other one gave us joy. One was related to empiricism, the other one to introspection. He also placed meat eaters on the one side, and vegetarians and those who did yoga on the other. From this moment onwards, I argued, in continental philosophy, the unrepresentable became exceedingly cool. And Hillel mentions Yankelevich, who was deeply indebted to Bergson, so I'm curious to hear more about that. So postmodern thinkers since then, such as Jean-François Lyotard, have continued this cult. In the famous book, The Postmodern Condition, Lyotard asks, but how to make visible that there is something that cannot be seen? And Lyotard found part of the answer in Kant's concept of the sublime. Kant had indeed thought carefully about something which he called a negative presentation. And he also related it directly to the famous passage in Exodus about not making graven images. Lyotard then, turning back to Kant and the sublime, he warned against, and I quote, confusing the Kantian sublime with Freudian sublimation, thus driving a wedge between the old way of thinking about unrepresentability in terms of lack to its opposite connotation, positive, productive, and sublime. So for Lyotard, it was the avant-garde who did unrepresentation the best, and he himself started to work with some of these alternative genres. He also admired Deleuze and Guattari, A Thousand Plateaus, and he poked fun at those who expected to, quote, to be gratified with a little sense when reading philosophy. That was very bad, if that's what you were looking for. So it may only be a slight exaggeration to claim that philosophy from the 1960s onward was concerned with finding the rules of representability on representability. You can think also of Kuhn's paradigms and their problematic relationship to grammatical paradigms, and of Foucault's epistemes as providing restrictions of what is seeable or enunciable at a given historical period. The problem was closely associated with the problem of ontogenesis, or how new things come to be. And more recently, it has become associated with media and with things. So if the role given by Kittler to the camera obscura to explain this fundamental change in the Renaissance, where the locus of authority behind the rules of representation and unrepresentation were first taken away from the church, seems preponderant, you can think of Marx's definition of ideology in terms of the camera obscura, and I will quote them. He claimed that what he called historical life processes were a camera obscura inversion of the physical life processes. He also said, in all ideology, men and their circumstances appear upside down, as in a camera obscura. So his point was simple. An illusory image lay at the root of every real image. Marx sought to expose this illusion, which was doubtlessly also a religious illusion in his mind. And he said, in direct contrast to German philosophy, which descends from heaven to earth, here we ascend from earth to heaven. So more than a century later, Kuhn turned to an experiment where a subject was given inverted glasses and asked to reorient himself in an upside-down world. And what happens is that it takes a few hours before you have a gestalt switch. So Kuhn used this experiment to make an intervention in the old chicken and egg question about is it the brain or is it the retina? And he used it to show the force of the structuring brain over retina, or in the case of physiology or in case of science, the paradigm in determining what we can see at a certain historical period. So one of the most important contributions... Oh, okay. I'm going to have to go faster. No, I'm actually pretty much done. Sorry about that. So one of the most important contributions of much of the recent work meant to rehabilitate the unrepresentable has been accompanied by an important shift in thinking about this dynamic. So instead of thinking of it, of truth in terms of atemporal schemas of representation or correspondence, you know, Richard Rorty refers to the mirror of nature philosophy. There's a focus on deeply temporal processes. So we have started to reclaim, I think, a different past where representation is no longer about identity and correspondence. And we can reread, for example, Locke to see that he was already concerned more with magic lantern analogies of cognition than camera obscura ones. I will go back to Kittler. And Kittler himself was very much inspired by Marshall McLuhan. And he argued that we cannot think about the representation without thinking about the technologies that enable it or that hamper it. But another of his points, I think, is more radical. So he urged us to think of what he called an underlying structure of the universe, essentially in terms of storage, transmission, and processing. His analysis became thus more critical than McLuhan. And McLuhan also was very much turned to theological references. So he wrote, for example, that the computer, in short, promises by technology a Pentecostal condition of universal understanding and unity. Kittler laughed and he said that the arch-Catholic media cult is one, quote, that confuses the Holy Spirit with a Turing's machine. So while McLuhan accepted uncritically the theological paradoxes that Hillel points in his essay, he instead started associating it with its opposite, the most mundane and the most brutal, such as war. So I will go back here to my reference to the dynamite. So drawing instead on Paul Virilio, he pointed out how war itself was a result of the play between representability and unrepresentability, or more prosaically, essentially a game of hide and seek. So to conclude, I do not want to remove the paradox of this question between the representable and its opposite, but I hope to point out some moments where we can start to think of the paradox in a way that's no longer clouded with either mystery or with miracles. So we'll end with that.